would you like to be introduced? And she said, you know, I really don't care. She said, but I'll tell you one thing. When I get up there to speak, I am so nervous, I'm really afraid that I'm going to wet my pants. So with mop in hand, I give you Geraldine D. from Blairstown, New Jersey.
This is an honest program, they tell me. I'm going to take him home for the long, long-term program. 5 to 25 years it's going to take. I think this is one of the most glorious weekends I've ever had in my life. And totally unexpected, because I came up here expecting a couple hundred people, maybe. Didn't know where Grant's Pass was. Never heard of it in my life. You know, I'm daring. I go lots of places. My name is Jerry Delaney, and I'm a very honored and grateful alcoholic and addict. You know, the mind's a wonderful thing. It starts working when you're born. And it never stops until you get up in a place like this and it just goes out the window. So you're going to have to listen with a great deal of tolerance. That's the most lovable characteristic, which allows you your opinion and me mine. And sometimes they differ. And I will try to watch my language. I try to drop out all the four-letter words ending in "is it uck and art." But I have a little trouble. But you see, I'm 78 years old, and I'm entitled to something. You know, alcoholism is a disease of denial and entitlement. And I'm entitled to some things, but I'm not going to tell you what. Not much. As I said, my name is Jerry, and I have been sober all day. And I've had about 13,500 days of sobriety, and you can work it out the best way you know how. I worked it out on a piece of paper. You can do the same thing. I would never have met any of you people if I hadn't have gotten in a whole lot of trouble. And everything I know about myself, I've learned in rooms like this. I came of a little different era than most people in here, because alcohol was the illegal drug in those days. And at 18, I wanted to be popular. You know, all 18-year-olds do. And we were doing a little importing of alcohol across the Canadian border. And I got so desirous of being popular that I decided to go with some friends and bring back some booze. So we went across the Canadian border, and we had a very unusual way of carrying it. We practiced a great deal before we went, because it was 2 hot water bottles strapped between your legs and tied around your waist. And you had to fill them up to the top so they wouldn't slosh. Because if you got out at the border, there might be something said about the sloshing. And let me tell you, when I came back with 2 quarts, 2 water bottles full of Canadian whiskey, I was very, very popular, because the rot gut that we were drinking in those days was something terrible. You think today of bootlegging's gone, don't you? I got news for you. I live up in the hills of New Jersey. And they got a little suspicious a month or so ago. The milk trucks were going up in the hills. Now there's farming country like this, you know, cows. Aren't there? No, there aren't there. There were no cows. And milk truck going up there? There was a still. Bringing it down, great big tagpoles at a time. So you see, nothing changes. Really. It's just the way you look at it. I didn't drink when I started running booze because nice girls didn't drink in those days. And I wanted to be a nice girl, but I wanted to be popular too. We drank a lot of things. I went to the parties and didn't drink. But finally one day, I was persuaded to try something. In the meantime, I had gone to work with the medical profession. And I'd gone to work with the medical profession, and for a slight fee, you could get an extra gallon of uncut alcohol in a tin can. And I brought it to the party. Well, now, we didn't get this every week, but we did get it. This old hag that sold it, I think, was a drunk, but I didn't know that then. And so I bring that gallon of uncut 180 proof alcohol, you know, make 2 gallons of what you drink now. And I was very popular. And we made what we call bathtub gin. Now, bathtub gin is straight alcohol, cut with a little water, and seasoned with a little juniper berry, and aged 15 minutes, and you drink it in hard cider, and you fly right over the moon. You see, I had another problem. But I was what they would call now a hyperkinetic child, slightly overactive. I'm slightly overactive now. And I don't know what they call me, but a lot of different names. But fetal barbital had come on the market, and they were going to take it like you take vitamins today, you know, carry around in your pocket, and you throw in a few in case you got nervous. And my mother insisted that I start this at age 17, and I guess it helped a little bit. But I was still taking them when I took that first drink. And honey, that really made me something. I'll tell you something. Booze did something for me that no one else in the world has been able to do. I was tall, and I didn't have buck teeth, and I didn't have a crooked nose, and I didn't have big ears. And I danced divinely. For the next 17 years, I was to try to get that feeling again. I got it once in a while, but not all the time. But I remember that first night, I can tell you how I felt when I went to the ladies' room. It's that vivid, and that's a long time ago, my friend. I didn't drink every day. I didn't drink gallons. I didn't get dead drunk, but I drank when I could. I had a problem as I went along. The problem was not me, of course. You understand that I never was a problem to me. I was a problem to everybody else in the United States, but not me. And I was traveling by that time about 8 months out of the year with 15 internationally known doctors, enjoying life, having a pretty gay time most of the time. But I had a problem, and that was my moral leper brother, who drank too much. He was a real moral leper. He's just terrible. He was always drunk. And I came to the point where I couldn't stand it any longer, and I called up a child psychiatrist. I always thought that was most appropriate. Not a psychiatrist, a child psychiatrist. The only one on the Eastern Seaboard. and said to Jim, "Jim, I've got a moral leper of a brother who's drunk all the time, and I don't know what to do with him. Do you?" Jim said, "No, Jerry, I don't know. Now, wait a minute. There was a guy at the Medical Society the other night in New York by the name of Bill Wilson, and he's doing something funny with men who drink too much. Not girls, you understand that? Men who drink too much. He said he gave me his card and I'll call him up and I'll get back to you." He called up Bill, and I'm so grateful tonight that Bill and two other guys went out to Maplewood, New Jersey to call on my brother. And that was in late October 1940. And Oscar went in to AA and stayed happily and successfully sober until his death a few years ago, and was always happy. I had advantages in those days that I didn't deserve. Bill and Lois spent many weekends at our home. I lived with my brother and his wife. His wife didn't want me very badly, and I had gotten there rather peculiarly, but Bill used to come out, and so I got to know both of them very well. When my brother got sober, you see, I didn't have a problem anymore, and I began to relax, and I began to drink a little more, and I began to take a few more pills. You could buy them 1,000 at a crack, and besides, they were in the office all the time, and I helped myself. And you wash it down with a little booze, and it really makes some problems in your life. I began to hit the hospitals, and I never paid the bills, anyhow. And along the way, I managed to see 27 psychiatrists. I didn't have to pay them anyhow. And every city that I went into, I saw to it that I had the name of a competent psychiatrist. And I would call him up and say, "I'm in town just for this special examination. And I wonder if I could see you for a few minutes." Well, with my position, they always said, "Oh, yes, I'd be glad to see you." And I would go to see them and tell them the sad, sad tale of my life and my drunken brother, who had to go into that thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And they felt very sorry for me. "Now, Jerry, you call me if you need me while you're here, won't you?" You see, I was building up a barrier against falling on my face, or so I could get put in the hospital. Now, I never had to pay the hospital bills, so it didn't matter. And I did work very hard, but I worked hard for the wrong reason, so people wouldn't find out what I was doing. Of course, I did not have a problem with alcohol. I want you to understand that. It was my nerves. And I saw psychiatrists, and I saw hospitals all over the United States. This went on for quite a few years while my brother was staying sober in AA. I was coming east to visit him, and sit at the kitchen table with a glass in my hand and say, "You don't think I'm an alcoholic, do you?" And he said, "No, drink it, dear. Hoping to God I'd pass out." And I did, frequently, and he left me on the kitchen floor, which is befitting a person of my standing. Doesn't everybody sleep on the floor? A friend of mine came into my bedroom, and I was lying between the beds on the floor, and she said, "Jerry, what are you doing on the floor?" I said, "I fell over the corner of the bed." "Well, you know, I'm too drunk to get up, even if I did." But you see, nothing very serious happened to me. How my brother kept his mouth shut, I will never know. But he did. He had good sponsors, good old timers, and he managed to keep his mouth shut. While I was carousing all over the country, he expected to hear any time that I was dead. Came the time when I hit the hospital in San Francisco, and I was unconscious for 10 days from an overdose. And when I finally came out of it, the doctors came in, sat down, and told me about it. And they said, "Jerry, you almost died." And I laughed in their face and said, "You can't kill the Irish." And in 3 hours after I left the hospital, I was drunk again. But I didn't have a problem, you understand that. It was my brother's problem. If he hadn't been such a drunk, I wouldn't be in this condition. Come the time when they decided they'd better send me to the Mayo Clinic for evaluation. For 3 months, the head neuropsychiatrist of the Mayo Clinic saw me every day, Saturdays and Sundays included. And he came up with a brilliant diagnosis. The only good psychiatrist I ever knew in my life. He said I was outrageously overworked and underpaid. And you know I agree with him. What I didn't know is he advised him to give me a year off to rest up with pay. And they called me in and said, "Now you'll be going on leave for a 4 year with all benefits, your car, your apartment, salary, the whole bit." And I was angry, incensed. They had not asked the Queen if she wanted a vacation. And I told them what to do with their job, and they did it. And I was surprised. Of course, there had been a couple of things. I think there were a couple of the pediatricians that were drunk, too, because there was a little matter of us getting thrown out of the Boston Motel, the head of Baby's Hospital. The gentleman is dead now, so I can talk about him. But we had been out and gotten a little bombed and came back, and the music was nice in the ballroom, and you know, we tripped down the stairs to the ballroom to dance. And they invited us to leave the floor, and we declined. And in a few minutes, the cops came and took us out. It seems that we had crashed a full dress Boston debutante ball. And in those days, my friends, there was nothing more formal. But that didn't bother anybody, you know. That didn't bother us at all. Incidentally, this man died an alcoholic. I was the fortunate one. But they put me on leave, and then I declined, and they gave me a tremendous bonus in five figures, which would amount to about $500,000 now. And I got drunk all over the United States. I spent it in 9 months and ended up $5,000 in debt. How I managed it, I will never know. But believe me, I lived high on the hog. And I had a good time, I thought. Except I can't remember any of it. And I lost my clothes along the way. You know, doesn't everybody leave their clothes in the airlines or one thing or another? I was back in Chicago, where I had started from. And one morning, I waked up. Now, I don't know about you, but I used to check out the ceiling to be sure it was mine and look casually to the right to be sure I was alone. And I did check out the ceiling, and it was not mine. And I turned my head to the right, and there were bars on the window. And when I looked to the left, there was a peephole in the door. And as Ray O'Keefe says so nicely, the sloppy architect forgot to put the doorknobs on. And you know, I'm a brilliant woman. I knew right where I was. I was in a nut factory. And that's right where I was. Now, I had called my brother, a moral leper, for 6 solid years. Never referred to him as my brother. If I added brother to it, was moral leper brother. And that morning, something happened to me. Because for the first time, I said out loud, if I ever get out of here, I'm going to call my brother and ask him if he will help me. And you know something? The first miracle of AA came to me about 20 minutes later. My brother stepped off of that elevator in that nut house in Chicago. He had been called in the night, but he'd been called many times and had declined to come. He had to borrow money, but was still in debt from his own drunkenness. And he'd flown out to Chicago in the night from New York. And he stepped off that elevator, and I was never as glad to see anybody in my life. And when they let me out to talk to him, he said, "Honey, you've made a pretty lousy mess out of your life. Do you want to do something about it?" Now remember that while he was in AA, he had been taking me to meetings. I was in the East about 3 times a year, and he would take me to meetings in South Orange and out of Morristown with two of the early groups. Why, out at Morristown one night they had an anniversary and they had a cake in the shape of a bottle with 3 feathers sticking out of it. Cute for those moral lepers. And I had been to those meetings, but I hadn't heard anything. And that morning in Chicago, he said, "You've made a pretty lousy mess out of your life. Do you want to do something about it?" Well, I didn't want to go around with that bunch of holy rollers that he was going around with. They're praying all the time. And I didn't believe in God. I'm powerful. But liars that we are, and let me tell you something, we are expert liars. We could sell that if we could bottle them. And I said, yes, I did want to do something. The next words out of his mouth were to plunge me to the bottom of a pit. He said, "I love you too much to be able to be objective about you. I can't help you." My heart went clear down to the basement. And it seemed like a century before he spoke again. I don't think it was over 60 seconds. When he said, "But I'll get someone." And we flew back to New York. Had to land out of downtown Pennsylvania in the hill country. I'm hungover. They had taken all my money away from me. Everything. And my brother was a professor. And he had to teach a couple of classes before we could go home because his wife didn't want to see me. I had supported them while he was drunk, but I made them pay through the nose for every dime of it. I was not generous at all. And so he took me to the lobby of a hotel in Newark to sit there while he taught a class at Rutgers. And he sat me down in that lobby with no money and no booze, hung over clear to my knees. I had been on pills for 19 years and the last 17 on booze too. And lots of it, not just a little bit, lots of it. And I'm dying sitting there. Now, I never went into a bar and had anybody buy me a drink in my life. But that day, I was so desperate. I went in the ladies' room to fix up myself, you know, and see if I could get the boys to buy me a drink. I took one look and gave it up. God, even I couldn't stand the sight of it. And that's pretty bad. And I sweat, and I sweat, and I sweat. And I went out, and finally he came, and we went home to his house. And it wasn't a very cordial atmosphere. And I slept in what had been his office. And he asked me if I thought I was an alcoholic. And I said yes, but I had my fingers crossed. I didn't mean a thing about it. And so they started taking me to meetings. They didn't say, dear, would you like to go to a meeting? They said, come on, we're going to a meeting. I don't feel like going. Who asked you if you felt like going? Oh, I'm taking my clothes off. Put them on. Oh, well, I don't want to. I'll come and put them on. And I said, oh, no, no, no. Can't have that. So I put my clothes on the way we go, and we went all over the state of New Jersey because there weren't very many groups then. They were taking me to meetings, and I want to express my gratitude to the non-alcoholic women tonight, because let me tell you something. They saved my life. That was a nice little men's club in those days, and they didn't want women in their midst. The men sat on one side of the room, and the women sat on the other. And the women let me sit with them and didn't make me feel like a moral leper. And I am eternally grateful to them. I couldn't be more grateful to them. And they would come with their husbands to pick me up and take me to meetings. And I was grateful for that. I was grateful, so grateful to those women. And they were to be part of me later. I want to remind you also that there wouldn't be an AA if there hadn't been a Lois Wilson. She was working in Macy's basement and supporting the drunks while they were going out trying to get another drunk to join them. And then one of them stole her blind, took everything in her house that was of any value. Did she throw them out? No. She kept on letting them come there. Don't ever forget to be grateful to Lois and to the other family members. This is a family disease. And don't you ever, ever forget it. And the women let me sit with them. And they invited me to their house. And little and by degrees, I began to get better. Wasn't sleeping very well, but I was able to do something. After 3 months, I went to work. I went to work at a job that paid me in a year what I made in a week before. And it was a very humbling experience. But I went just the same, and I saved some money. And after going to meetings for about 8 months, and reading the big book, incidentally, the big book was given to me on my 40th birthday. It was the worst written book I had ever read in my whole life. And I threw it out the window in the snowbank. But it was a most unusual book. That night it was back on my night table. So I put it in the dirty linen going out to the laundry. And that night it was back on my night table. And then I put it in the garbage. Came back on the night table, a little greasy, but it was bad. I want you to know that this smart aleck has never been able to write a book like this, although I says any idiot can write a book better than that, which labels me as an idiot because I can't. I have come to love that book and the simplicity of it and the great things that it has to offer. This particular night, I had come home from a meeting and I'd saved some money. I had memorized the 12 steps. I knew all about the program. There wasn't anything that I didn't know. I was bright, you understand. I was so dumb I didn't know I was stupid. That was my problem. But that night, I decided that I was going to go back to Chicago and join my friends and drink like a lady. I never wanted to be anything but a lady. But this is what I've been doing. I wasn't going to tell anybody. Not going to tell anybody at all. Had all my plans set up. But something happened that Sunday night. I sat down on the side of the bed, as I had so many nights before, feeling sorry for myself. But that night, I reached over and picked up the big book. And it fell open to page 57 in the old edition, the chapter on how it works. And I began to read. And this, to me, was the second miracle of AA in my life. And I began to read. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I was following a path of destruction and knew it. But seeing it in those words, that word honest jumped out of that paragraph. It was an inch high. It hit me right in the head. And as I read on, I did something that I have never done before or since. I read the 12 steps in the first person. Now, you know they're not written in the first person. They're written as we. Thank you. I began, I admit that I am powerless over alcohol, that my life has become unmanageable. I was copping out on the we. We was you. Had nothing to do with me. I read on through the 12 steps that way, closed the book, laid down on the bed, went to sleep, had the first decent night's sleep I'd had in 8 months, the first decent night I'd had since stopping the pills and alcohol, and wakened the next morning with a whole new outlook. That, to me, was a gift from God. I never again wanted to leave AA. I never again wanted to go back to join my old friends. It was taken from me. My learning was slow because, remember, I'm flaky. I thought I was all right, but around the AA clubhouse, they used to say that sister of Oscar's may be a nice girl, but she's got a screw loose. And it wasn't jacked down too tight, I'm sorry to report. I could hold a job of sorts, this job at the hospital, but any idiot could hold it, that it had the kind of training that I did. And I went on, going to meetings, began working with people. You see, I was number four woman in New Jersey. The woman before me had been in 3 months. And she was sent to see me. And she went home and cried to her husband, "This is the first time I've ever been asked to see anybody. Why did they send me to see somebody hopeless?" We both had our anniversaries this year. Now, going to meetings, you're bound to meet somebody, aren't you? And I met a great, big, tall Irishman when I was sober about a year and a half. Very handsome, very interesting. But I want you to know that he was a 49-year-old Irish Roman Catholic bachelor, never been married, and came complete with aged mother as a package. I am Hartshell Baptist, career and divorced at that time. I fit in that family like a bee in an anthill. But I loved him the day I met him, and I loved him the day he died. He had less time in AA than I did. I pointed out to him that we shouldn't get married. He was determined we did. And we did. Now, out of the church, which was hard on him and hard on his family, but it was his idea. And then we began to go to what you now call a couples group. They didn't have such a fancy name for it then. It was a family affair, and the family went to all meetings anyway. But on Saturday night, about five or six couples would meet together over a potluck supper at somebody's house, and we would discuss some knotty problem in somebody's life. I'm glad to report that all that group stayed together. And I believe the family that prays together stays together, but I also believe that the family that goes to AA and Al-Anon together stays together. Al-Anon started along the way, and it wasn't very well attended in the beginning. The men frowned upon it, and I didn't think I needed it, of course. Being married to an alcoholic would be better, wouldn't it? A good marriage is a good marriage is a good marriage. Doesn't make any difference whether they're drunk or not. And marrying this man was an experience that I shall never forget. I wouldn't not do it. I hope I wouldn't do it again. But we went to lots of meetings, and time went by. He became successful. I became successful. And I worry about people who go up in AA too fast. Tom was Mr. AA, Mr. Intergroup Chairman, Mr. This, Mr. That in the state of New Jersey. And he began to get bored. But he had a bad back. And one of the AA boys gave him some pills for his back and said, "Don't tell Jerry, she's a nut on those things." And he took them and didn't tell me, and it helped his back. And 2 weeks later, he had a cough, and the man gave him some cough medicine with the same instructions, "Don't tell Jerry, she's a nut on that." I have always said that your body doesn't care whether the mood changer is liquid or solid, whether it is you drink it, stick it in your arm, snuff it up your nose, or what you do with it. It's looking for the change of mood. And I say to every one of you, if you've got to change your mood that I get from a drink, you'd be a drunk too. You're not a bit smarter. You're not a bit better educated. You haven't any better family than I have. I found out in AA that my father was a periodic. But for a hard shell Baptist to be drunk in the Bible Belt was unheard of in those days. And he was drunk twice in my life. And the first time I said, who wouldn't drink married to an old witch like my mother? The second time I was married to Tom and said, why does he do this to me? Now, my mother was an alcoholic and died an alcoholic, but I did not recognize her. Verna was a closet drinker. Now, Verna would have occasional gallbladder attacks. You know, very sick, thrown up. She had terrible times. And the local doctor who had been educated by my father would arrive and he'd give her the new medicine. The new medicine on the market. Guess what it was? Heroin. Better than morphine. Yes, in those days. Over the counter. You got heroin over the counter until 1956 and cough medicine, my friend. Don't you forget it. That was an era that was high, wide, and handsome. Verna was really a drunk, and later she would try to get sober. I sent her an AA book. When she died some years later, I found the AA book and all of my letters about AA between the spring and mattress of her bed, but she'd never been able to make it. She would do such things like call me up in the middle of the night, 3 o'clock in the morning, to tell me she had a cataract. And I'd say, why didn't you call me earlier? She said, I was asleep. Doesn't that sound like a drunk? Do you think I could see it? No, uh-oh. I thought she was, but I wasn't really very sure, you know. All of these things are right under my nose, and I didn't see my husband getting into trouble either. And after the cough medicine that the friend gave him, in 3 days, after 20 years of sobriety, my friends, 20 good years, he was in the bar. 17 months later, after 14 hospital, he died of an esophageal hemorrhage. He bled to death alone in a halfway house. Your length of sobriety does not take away your disease, my friends. I tell this because at the time this happened, I was about to stop talking about people taking other drugs. And I believe God sent this experience to me so that I will never, never stop talking about drugs. During his drinking, I was to come to know that I had truly found faith. Along the way, they asked me why I didn't say the Lord's Prayer. And I declined to answer. And they said, would it hurt you? And I said, well, I guess not. My friends, I couldn't remember. That's why I didn't say it. I couldn't remember the Lord's Prayer. After being brought up in a Christian home, this is pretty sad. As time went on, Somebody suggested that I call God Good Orderly Direction, and that seemed all right. At that time, I had not looked back and seen the miracles of me reading the 12 steps in the first person and my desire being taken away, or my brother coming to the hospital as miracles. I hadn't seen it at that time, but I began to see that there was something more that I had missed. And during my husband's illness, he became violent, as all drunks revert to what they were, only more so. And he went after me with a shotgun one night. God gave me some special strength and faith to sit there with that loaded shotgun at my head for 20 minutes and not move and not say anything. And he dropped the shotgun and went away. A few weeks later, he called up and said, "I'm at the corner. I've got a gun and I'm going to get you this time." I went back and sat on the bed. By this time, I was running a rehab, not because I wanted to, but because it was dropped in my lap and I had to do it. They called and he said, "I'm going to get you this time." And again, the miracles of AA came, because on the end table was the letter from a dear AA friend that I had slid open to the end read. I picked it up in the days that you're in when you're full of doubt and fear. I picked it up and a card fell out. And it was a card of the prayer of St. Francis de Sales, which goes something like this: "Be not afraid. The self-same Father who took care of you yesterday will take care of you today and every day. Either he will shield you from suffering, or, don't forget the or, he will give you ample courage to face it." Ample courage to face it. I read that about 15 times and again laid down in the bed and went to sleep. He wakened in the morning and he hadn't come. And I was alive, but I suddenly knew that I had faith. It had been given to me, and there was no trouble in me talking about God. As I began to go in to spirituality, I began to realize that I had religion, formal religion, organized religion, all mixed up with my spiritual values. Now, I don't care how people serve their God at their table. I could care less what faith it is or anything of the sort. But spirituality to me is having living standards that I believe, in the eyes of the God of my understanding, will be acceptable. That took some time for me to set up living standards. It wasn't easy for me. I had to do a lot of work, all the time going to meetings. Part of it, I think, that helped me was being in the work that I was in. I didn't want to work with alcoholics. A dear friend of mine was starting what she called a vacation place for alcoholics. And she wanted me to help her. And I said, "Look, my mother had some crazy children, but I'm not one of them. I wouldn't do what you do." But I had loaned her $50,000 on unsecured notes. And 3 weeks later, she dropped dead. And I couldn't afford to lose that money.
And guess who started running it? And guess who's running it 26 years later? And I have learned a lot about tolerance, about spiritual guidance, about things not to do and things to do. And I've learned a lot about the intellectual garbage that gets thrown around. You remember that the last words Dr. Bob said to Bill were, "Don't louse it up, Bill. Keep it simple." And I read that over and over again, because on a set of cards I have a mess of one-liners, which I keep on my bed because I don't know when trouble's going to come. And a one-liner will keep me out of trouble. Another thing I use to keep me out of trouble is a large print Bible. I keep it on my desk and flip it over in the morning and read just one paragraph. I confine myself to one paragraph at random. It changes my thinking. And usually when I come home at night, I read it again and maybe read a little further. Now you say, why the large print? You know, when we're in a hurry, we think, well, I'll read it later, that's awful fine print. How many times have you done that? Ask yourself. Treat yourself to a large print Bible. And while you're doing it, treat yourself to a large print dictionary. You say, I know what words mean. That's what I said. But there are a lot of things that I don't know all the meanings to. Because when you say something to me, I will ask you, I know what resentment means, I know what love means, but what do you mean by resentment or love or whatever the word is? Because our meanings may not be the same. And as a result, we misunderstand each other and we don't get it down to the basis. I believe of all the things in AA that have caused me trouble, words are things that have caused me trouble, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit about a couple of them. One of them was alcohol ick. The ick is dirty, isn't it? Now, they had called it Jelinek's disease after the great Dr. Jelinek, which they thought of doing at one time. Wouldn't it be nice to say you're going for Jelinek's therapy? It doesn't make any difference anymore, but it did cause me a lot of trouble. Then the word addiction. Well, I'm not addicted. Look in the dictionary, my friends. Addiction is pain plus a learned relief. Certainly as an alcoholic, I had pain. I had not physical pain. I had emotional pain, I had spiritual pain, I was bankrupt. And I learned relief, which was chemicals. My drug of choice was alcohol, but the other things were available, and they didn't smell, so I took them in the morning and I drank at night, every night. I killed the pain of whatever it was. Now, I found that that painkiller no longer worked with me. It gave me more pain than it killed. What am I going to do? I'm going to have to become addicted again. What to? To something else. And you know what I've become addicted to? The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And every day, I go up those steps from 1 to 12. You don't do well going up or down if you skip one. And you better learn how to take them. Because for me, the addiction to AA has taken away pink. Do I ever get sloppy and have pink? Of course. And then I know it is not those around me, but it is me. The pain that I had from being the wife of an alcoholic. When Tom got sick, it was the Al-Anon ladies who said to me, "Oh, knock it off, Jerry. You're being an idiot." And they held me together. They glued me together. So, currently, today, I'm addicted to AA. After more than 38 years, it works. And as I said this afternoon, or this morning, or whenever, whether I was talking, if it works, don't fix it. Now, I didn't like it being chronic. I had a problem. But what's chronic? Simply means long-lasting. And this disease lasts as long as you breathe, my friends. Oh, it doesn't show itself unless you activate it, and then you're in trouble. When I'd been sober about 2 years, I got real smart, you know. We have periods of getting smart. And I got very smart. And I decided I would go for expert advice. And I went to Dr. Ruth Fox, a learned psychiatrist in New York who brought ant abuse to this country, and told her that I thought I should do better than I was doing. She said, "How's your work?" And I said, "Fine. How's your family?" "Fine. Are you getting any aid?" "Yeah." She said, "Did it ever occur to you that it takes 2 years to get your brains out of hock and 3 more to get them unscrambled? And then you start to grow?" Oh boy, was I mad. She can't talk like that to me. And then I challenged her on the addiction, on the diagnosis that I had had. I had been diagnosed manic depressive. Lovely word, isn't it? And it sounded good. And I thought talking to a psychiatrist, that'd be fine. She said, "Yes, you are." Said, "Half the time you're up and I can't get you with a skyhook, and the rest of the time you're down in the basement and I can't dig you up with a spade." She said, "All we're trying to do is get your manic depressive in normal limits." She said, "Every alcoholic and every person I know has mood swings, and only in direct proportion to them being able to control it are they comfortable, able to deal with reality today as an adult, not a stumbling child." She made things so simple. She was a good friend of Bill's, and she learned about him, all this stuff from him. And I said, "Well, I'm paranoid too." She said, "You should be. Every person in AA is watching you like a hawk because they expect you to go get drunk again." And she said to Rachel Gorn, "You're going to make it." And, you know, she just took the wind out of my sails, something awful, and I just didn't appreciate it worth a nickel. And I thought she could be a little more gentle with me. And as time went on, I began to work more on words. And I found that experience, working with people, working with AA, going to meetings, these various experiences are a form of learning. Then people were saying, "Well, they were depressed." Called my friend Dr. Fox. "What's depression?" Because by that time I knew she had simple answers for delicate questions. And she gave me the best answer I've ever heard. "Unresolved discontent, and you're too lazy to get off your butt and do something." That is depression, my friend, so don't be depressed. Inventory. I haven't heard much about inventory here today. Inventory is very important to me. Every time I'm uncomfortable, I take a written inventory. And once a year, every January, because that's my vacation, I take a full-scale written inventory of my assets and my liabilities. This year I found out something very interesting. Procrastination has been on the list every year for 5 years. Now that there's something wrong here. So I began to look at the word procrastination. I always said procrastination is my sin. It brings me endless sorrow. I really should stop doing it. In fact, I think I'll stop tomorrow. And I began to work on it. And you know something? I had to take procrastination off the liability column. Because part of the time procrastination for me was an asset. I didn't get myself into some lousy things that I would do on the spur of the moment. And when I go to write something, I find that if I do it at the last minute, I write better, I'm more creative, and it works out better. So I had to move it. So I found a new column for it, enjoyment, because I enjoyed procrastinating. There are so very many things that I could share with you, but if you, you know, the head can absorb only what the seat can stand. And if you've been sitting there as long as I've been sitting, you're getting tired of hearing this. I've had a wonderful time at all the meetings, but there's so much I can take care of. They were talking this afternoon about the 12 promises, and certainly we know a lot of freedom and a lot of happiness. Everybody in this room that's sober tonight has realized that. This is today. It doesn't say next month, next year. It says, what are you doing today? You've got a full-time job living today. I'm lucky to even get through it. And when I get up in the morning, my friends, at 78 years old, and I put my feet on the floor, I got a plus. And if I can see, I got two pluses. And I got friends like you. Who's got to worry about it? I haven't anything to worry about. That, to me, is serenity, knowing that I got the best of the whole world. How did I get it? Through being a drunk, having Alcoholics Anonymous around. And so, I have grown and hope to grow every day. I have grown here at this meeting. I've heard some wonderful things. I'm taking these tapes home to share with my loved ones who weren't fortunate enough to come. I'm grateful to the committee for asking me and bringing me out here. You have such a gorgeous community out here. First, look at this room full of people who are staying sober one day at a time. And look at the number of women. This is wonderful. And every place you go, AA is at hand. All you have to do is pick up the phone. Out in Nassau, I got lonely. I picked up the phone, called AA, and a little boy answered the phone. Well, I'm all nonplussed about that. And I said, are your mother or father home? No, they are not home, madam. Have they gone to a meeting, you know, still being tactful? Do you have trouble, madam? Please to give me your telephone number. I said, no, I don't have trouble. Please to give me your telephone number anyway. I found out he was 8 years old. Within 5 minutes, that English family were standing in the lobby of that hotel. They never even bothered to call me. And I went out to a family meeting. And it was was simply wonderful. Clear out there, having a lot of fun. And there's so many things that have happened to me that I wish I could pass on to you. First, sobriety. Second, the simple faith, the kind of a faith you had as a child. Remember when you prayed for a bicycle and you got roller skates? It took you about 30 seconds to make up your mind you wanted roller skates to begin with. That's the kind of faith you better have in AA. Whatever you get, you've got, and you better like it. And so, as I go back to the East Coast via Denver and Oklahoma City, I'll be thinking about you and all you've given me and all I can take home with me, and wishing you things that I can't give you, but God can. I wish you courage to be warm when the world would prefer that you be cool. I wish you success sufficient to your needs, and I wish you a little failure to temper that success. I wish you joy in all your days, but I wish you sadness so that you may better measure your joy. I wish you gladness to overbalance any grief, and I wish you humor and a twinkle in your eye. I wish you glory and the strength to bear its burdens, and I wish you sunshine on your way. I wish you peace in a world of turmoil, and I wish you peace in the smallest corner of your heart where the truth is really kept. And I wish you faith to help define your living and your life. More I cannot wish you except love and continued sobriety to make all the rest worthwhile. And at night, I say just a little short prayer, just as I say in the morning, God, I need your help. I'll try, and I know you'll help. And at night, I always say each night, I ask God to take my hand. It's better this way, I know. Because if I take His, instead of His taking mine, I may get afraid and let go. And I don't want to let go of you or the God of my understanding. And tonight I wish you all that I have tonight. On another day of sobriety, God willing. Thank you for being so gorgeous to me. I love you all.